It's Friday, August 14th. Tampering with the mail is a big no-no. What if you just let it sit around, though? We start here. That thing being whispered? Well, President Trump just said it out loud.
If we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they can't have universal mail-in voting.
New concerns about the role of the post office as Election Day draws near. Most Arab countries don't have an Israeli embassy. There's about to be one more.
The confrontation with Iran, that's what's really underlying it.
In a deal sending shockwaves through the Mideast, the White House brokers a deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And this was way bigger than a tornado.
I would compare it to a hurricane hit Iowa.
Why it only took a few hours for Iowa's corn farms to be decimated. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
Today, I want to talk about one thing, very straightforward.
Yesterday, Joe Biden and his new running mate, Kamala Harris, made their first appearance since that big announcement event earlier this week.
Every single American should be wearing a mask when they're outside for the next 3 months at a minimum.
They arranged a big briefing on a coronavirus response and then delivered remarks afterward. They did not take questions.
Sleepy Joe rejects the scientific approach in favor of locking all Americans in their basements for months on end.
President Trump did take questions from reporters, first in an interview with Fox Business, then later in the White House briefing room.
But what people can never prepare for are millions and millions of mail-in ballots, because they can be forged, they can be captured, they can be taken.
But when you think about the election in November, you got the healthcare issue of the virus. We've talked about that many times. And then there's the electoral issue of how votes are actually counted. Going back to ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer this morning, because Devin, just earlier this week, I was asking you whether the president would ever wield the Postal Service possibly as a political weapon. He almost seemed to answer that question himself yesterday. What is going on with the Postal Service?
Yeah, he sure did, Brad. I mean, he has been doubling down on these attacks on people's confidence in the Postal Service to deliver mail ballots, which they've been doing, by the way, since the Civil War.
They want $25 billion, billion. For the post office.
In an extraordinary interview with Fox Business yesterday, he basically said he was going to block this Democratic request for $25 billion in emergency relief funds for the post office during the pandemic.
Because the post office is going to have to go to town to get these great, ridiculous ballots in.
In large part, to stop them from carrying this expected surge of what he said are millions and millions of ballots.
If we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they can't have universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it. So, you know, sort of a crazy thing.
How many Very states?
Now, it's not clear how much of the rhetoric is meant to be leveraged in these negotiations, which, as you know, have stalled over the relief package. But the president is stirring up these concerns that the post office is up to the job. But here's the bottom line, Brad. The post office has been in the red for years. The mail hasn't stopped. In fact, despite his warnings, there is no evidence the Postal Service can't handle the surge in ballots this year. The president of the American Postal Workers Union told me this week that this year's election mail will be a cakewalk.
That is reprehensible. I just am taken aback that he would verbalize it. And I think that there has been a pattern of voter suppression.
But that's what I wanted to ask you, Devin, is if President Trump himself is saying the Postal Service needs more money if they want to get everyone's votes counted quickly and accurately, I'm not going to give them that money because of the idea of how votes will be counted. Does that amount to voter suppression? What is it? Can you do that?
Although there will likely be an unprecedented increase in election mail volume due to the pandemic, the Postal Service has ample capacity to deliver all election mail securely and on time.
Well, his own hand-picked Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, someone who is a very controversial figure in his own right, is not backing up the president on that point, Brad. I mean, in fact, he's been publicly saying this month that the Postal Service can handle the election mail. They will handle all those ballots that are expected. No problem. They will do it in a timely and professional manner.
But we also need to recognize our issues and urgently embrace the changes required to unleash the full range of possibilities. and we need to start yesterday.
But what there's no question, the Postal Service is in dire financial straits, needs the money. They have been struggling, but you've got the union and the president's own Postmaster General on the same page saying that either way, they're committed to the ballots, but they could use some help right now.
We do ask election officials and voters to be mindful of the time that it takes for us to deliver ballots.
But Brad, there's this whole other category of delays that's also embroiling the post office this election season. It has nothing to do with their delivery, but rather with the deadlines that states are setting for when voters can request ballots, when they have to get them back by the Postal Service, saying some of those deadlines are simply too tight and it's not their fault. We came across this letter that the Postal Service sent in a case in Pennsylvania last month warning the state that its deadlines allowing some people to request a ballot just 7 days before the election is simply too tight for them to turn around both the application and the completed ballot in time to be counted on election day. Brett, a number of states have these tight deadlines. In fact, some allow people to request by mail a mail-in ballot the day before the election.
Wait, one day before? Like, Devin, we called it snail mail well before 2020.
You know, hard to know how many people try to do that or take advantage of that, but the Postal Service is pushing back a little bit here in a number of states saying, wait a second, you either need to adjust your deadlines or you need to allow postmarked ballots to be counted late after the fact. All of this, though, Brad, just a reminder to all of us, get those ballot requests in early. Everybody in every state can request them today. And when you get the ballot in September and October, don't wait. Fill it out. Get it in. And most people will be just fine.
Yeah. And President Trump, we found out, actually just requested his mail ballot in Florida this week. But Devin,
right.
You mentioned earlier that this could all also, everything to do with President Trump, could also be an issue with how that big coronavirus relief package on Capitol Hill is going down. How does that work?
Well, Democrats and Republicans, Brad, are basically not talking anymore over this fourth COVID relief package, the billions of dollars for small businesses, for testing for states. Some of that money Democrats want to go to help states print more mail ballots that are expected this year. And so the president here is trying to sort of stick it to Democrats and say their request is too high.
If they make a deal, the Postal Service is taken care of, the money they need for the mail-in ballots would be taken care of if we agreed to it. That doesn't mean we're going to agree to it.
And he's going to stand in the way of that.
You saw what was happening in Virginia, where piles of ballot applications are dropped all over the state. They had them named after dogs. They had them named after dead people. We want to have an accurate vote. I'm not doing this for any reason. Maybe the other turns out to be my advantage. I don't know. I can't tell you that. But I do know this. I just want an accurate vote.
Arizona is, if not the pioneer, a model of excellence for mail-in balloting.
I should also say, Brad, so much of this boils down to the president's belief, contrary to any evidence, that mail-in voting only helps Democrats.
It's entirely possible that we will not be able to announce or declare a winner on that evening.
Susan Collins, a vulnerable Republican, says she disagrees strongly with Trump on this issue. And
members of his own party disagree with him on that, but he has drawn a line in the sand on this relief package over the post office. Meanwhile, millions of Americans around the country right now are looking for that financial relief from Congress, and they're not going to get it anytime soon as this stalemate drags on and members of the Senate, Brad, head home for a month-long vacation.
Wow. All right. Devin Dwyer in Washington. Thanks so much for the clarity.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, if the Trump administration needed a win, they might have just gotten one in the Middle East. Back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We have gotten so little good news this year. A headline about a Mideast peace deal would have seemed like a cruel joke a few days ago. Think of it. Over the course of the last couple years, Israel has taken new steps to annex disputed chunks of land, to build apartments and factories on them over the objections of Palestinians. And while this has enraged much of the Muslim world, it has all come with the explicit approval of the Trump administration.
This deal is a significant step towards building a more peaceful, secure, and prosperous Middle East.
Well, yesterday, President Trump announced the U.S. had brokered a peace deal between Israel and one of the richest Muslim nations in the world, the United Arab Emirates. Let's get into it. Let's break this down with ABC's senior national correspondent Terry Moran in Washington and ABC's Jordana Miller, who's based in Jerusalem. Terry, let's start with you. How big of a deal is this?
You know, it is a big deal, like a shaft of light in a dark year.
Well, today we usher in a new era of peace between Israel and the Arab world.
Israel and one of the Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates, struck a deal. They're going to cooperate like normal countries on security and tourism technology on a coronavirus vaccine. And at the heart of the deal, and this is what makes it important, is this. Israel's agreed to suspend declaring sovereignty over parts of the West Bank that Palestinians have long thought of as the land that will be their future state.
To start with, we have a clear commitment to stop annexation.
Israel has been, as you pointed out, gradually taking it over. Israel's going to suspend declaring sovereignty over it. And in exchange, the United Arab Emirates are going to treat Israel like a normal country.
The two states will exchange embassies and ambassadors and meet in the coming weeks to sign bilateral agreements regarding investment, tourism, direct flights, security, telecommunications, and other issues.
And it could be a breakthrough that starts something happening here.
Well, obviously a huge moment for the Trump administration's foreign policy, but Jordana, how is this being seen in Israel and around the region?
Well, the irony is that here in Israel, it is making people happy who are not traditional supporters of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
You know, as an Israeli, you know, we want peace with all of our neighbors. And so peace with them is, you know, one very big step in that direction.
Firstly, the leftists. The peace camp and the centrists, people who Netanyahu often demonizes.
And I hope there will be other agreements with other Arab states.
But they've won two victories. One, the postponement of possible annexation moves by Israel in the disputed West Bank. And two, this commitment to a new peace deal between, you know, from the United Arab Emirates, which, you know, as Terry was saying, this is a huge deal because it's the first time in really 26 years that Israel has had any kind of real movement towards peace.
This deal will allow much greater access to Muslims from throughout the world to visit the many historic sites in Israel, which the Muslims want to see very badly and have wanted to see for many, many decades.
The losers are clearly people in Netanyahu's base because, you know, he has had to give up for now the idea of extending Israeli sovereignty, annexing parts of the disputed West Bank, what his right wing base and his far right wing base believe, you know, belong to Israel and the Jewish people.
Toda rabba lachem. Toda, toda, toda.
No one really knows if Netanyahu is ever serious about annexing parts of the disputed West Bank. It may have been, and many people have argued that it was simply a political ploy to get those right-wing voters to, you know, to cast their ballots in his favor so that he could stay in power, which he managed to do.
But Netanyahu, in a speech later on Thursday, said annexing parts of the West Bank, territory Palestinians seek for their own state, was still on the table, and that the Trump administration asked Israel to, quote, temporarily suspend doing so in order that Thursday's peace deal be reached.
The other loser here is the Palestinians.
A lot of people in the region are seeing that we can't wait for the Palestinian leadership to try and resolve this.
So they are, as so often, forlorn in the region, really under Israeli domination. But as far as the big strategic play here, which is the confrontation with Iran, that's what's really underlying it. Secretly, underground, for years, Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have been cooperating in resisting and confronting Iran in the region.
Yeah, Jordana, walk me through that dynamic, because on the surface, these countries never get along, and yet it sounds like in the shadows for years they've been dealing with each other.
Right. I was going to say there's definitely a generational shift.
The city of Haifa and its harbor become the center of bitter conflict as the new Jewish state is born in the tense atmosphere of civil war.
The consensus when Israel was founded in 1948 was that the entire Arab world was going to stand against Israel. There was going to be a monolithic diplomatic boycott of Israel. And slowly it started to break with first Egypt, then Jordan. And essentially the Palestinian leadership, the Palestinian president is saying, hey, you know, you've betrayed us because, you know, you've kind of thrown us under the bus. We were supposed to make a deal first and you would follow. And instead, we see the United Arab Emirates breaking and signing their own peace deal with Israel.
And I think you'll be seeing some very exciting things, including ultimately with the Palestinians. I think that's going to be happening at some point.
All right. So, Terry, what's next?
Well, first, credit where credit is due. President Trump likes to think of himself as a disruptor. If there's any place that needed disrupting, it was the Middle East.
When you look at what's happening, you're seeing a lot of progress is being made that nobody thought could possibly be made.
He will use it as an election issue, and rightly so. What's next is Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is a very good ally from the standpoint that we get along with them very well.
That is a country which, like the UAE, although much more important, much bigger, much wealthier, much more powerful in the region and the world, has been underground, secretly cooperating with Israel for years, had its own peace plan on the table a few years back, and all three leaders in the joint statement suggested other Arab nations will follow. I think first in line is going to be Saudi Arabia. It's a new day in the Middle East.
Yeah, big moment for the Trump administration and just a huge tectonic shift for the region. If Sunni Muslim countries in the region are going to say, you know what, we are going to forge these ties officially now, out in the sunlight with Israel, changes a lot of dynamics. Terry Moran, Jordana Miller, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
We've talked about how COVID-19 could affect your food supply, right? You know, if everyone's getting sick at a meat processing plant, there's going to be less meat for sale. Well, forget COVID. Another wrecking ball just plowed into one of America's most important crop regions. They call this a derecho. Not quite a tornado, but a really fast-moving storm that blasts through an area as if it's on a zip line. That is what just ripped through Iowa farmland. And yesterday, Vice President Mike Pence arrived to survey the aftermath.
I just met with families who literally have seen virtually their entire crop wiped out.
I want to go to Rachel Droz. She's the chief political correspondent and investigative reporter at our affiliate WOI in Des Moines, Iowa. Rachel, how bad is the damage there?
You know, it is absolutely unbelievable. It's unlike anything I've seen in terms of just how widespread it is.
You had reports of DeWitt, Iowa to Chicago having 80 plus mile per hour winds.
There goes Mama Van.
Days later, even, there is still power outages, still trees on houses, still roads blocked.
It's going to take several days for power to be restored. That's from both MidAmerican and Align Energy after speaking with them today. And right now, that's over 200,000 people in the Cedar Rapids area. Now
they're still doing all this cleanup, and that's not even to mention the farm fields.
It'll be a real nightmare to try to get the combine through here and pick that up.
Anything bent is gone.
That's a green snap, and the plant is dead from there on up, which unfortunately includes the ear.
Corn, of course, this time of year is normally standing straight up, pretty tall, but a lot of these fields are just completely flat. The corn actually has blown over. Some of it snapped, but some of it actually blew out of the ground.
So that derecho, what is it? You hear that name? It's a long line of thunderstorms that covers more than 250 miles.
I mean, I would compare it to a hurricane hit Iowa.
Wow. So obviously different from your average storm, just in terms of the devastation. Are the ramifications different as well because of where it hit, because it's so many farmlands here?
I think so. Now, we have been running a surplus the past few years of our grain supply, so that is going to be a little bit helpful, but this could impact, from what I've been told, the food supply. Hopefully it doesn't. There is still a decent amount of corn up, but 33%, early estimates show 33% of all of Iowa's crops are damaged.
Currently, it's estimated that Monday's strong winds and storms destroyed 10 million acres of farmland here in Iowa.
Add that into the pandemic, and this could be looking like some major ramifications for America's food supply.
Yeah, would this be playing out the same if it was 2019, Rachel, or is there something about this year during a pandemic that makes it more complicated? Are there differences here?
You know, it's tough to say. Right now, the response hasn't been different from what I've seen other storm responses as. This seems pretty run-of-the-mill in terms of how the state is responding, if the federal government needs to be involved. The only difference that I personally have noticed is we didn't have to activate our state emergency operations center because it's already up for COVID-19.
The Red Cross has set up in Thomas Park in Marion. They can only allow 15 people in the space at a time due to the pandemic. People can get their phones charged, but if they need shelter, the Red Cross is putting people in hotels.
But we're also only a few days past the storm, so that's not to say that there aren't going to be problems. One thing that I've been thinking about is how are you going to rebuild some of these places if there's shortages of building materials? How are you going to get the materials that you need to rebuild these grain bins that got just completely leveled when there's shortages of that material? I mean, you can't get there's a shortage of aluminum cans, so how can you expect to rebuild these ginormous grain bins?
You just got to kind of pull up your boots and put your best foot forward and go from there.
I will say, earlier this week, I spoke with farmers that typically when I talk to them, they are the most optimistic. Farmers, if you meet them, if you are a farmer, you know they are the most optimistic group of people. But the farmers that I spoke to earlier this week were broken. They really were wondering how they're going to pull out of this, because this isn't just one incident. This is an incident on top of years of problems that they've been facing.
Right, that is Rachel Droz from our great affiliates in Des Moines, Iowa, WOI. Rachel's actually standing on the Iowa State Fairgrounds right now, which I know would normally be such a celebratory moment in Iowa. Not this year, and sadly, not this week especially. But Rachel, be well. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And one last thing. This week in Newcastle, England, the world saw what a socially distanced concert could look like. Music artists lately have been doing lots of live streams, even drive-in concerts, but this is different. This is a huge outdoor space with 2,500 audience members. But they're all in groups seated well over 6 feet apart. See, everyone's seated on a small platform with some metal fencing around it. That platform can hold up to 5 people. The key here is they're your people, a pod of people whose germs you're probably already inhaling. And from the distance between pods, to the pre-ordered food you pick up without waiting in line, to the porta-potties cleaned between every use, the idea here is you don't come in close contact with anyone else during the show, but you're still experiencing the music and the rest of the crowd along with you in person.
Right in front of me.
Now, if you've ever had beer spilled on you by a really loud stranger in an arena, you might say, sign me up. But if this is what it takes, think of the costs involved. This was held at a racetrack that can usually hold 20,000 people. This was 1/8 of that. Those big metal stands, they cost a lot more to build than setting up 5 plastic chairs. The concert organizers, though, say this is actually a profitable setup. One, because this venue was designed back in April specifically with socially distanced concerts in mind. They figured, we're going to be here for a while, we'll make the investment. Your small local indoor venue will have a way tougher time with this. Then there's the fact that the bands here were willing to take a 25% pay cut, which is still a lot more than they've been making online. Same with the lighting companies, the stage designers, the food tent folks, even porta potties. Think of how rough of a time this has been for the porta potty industry, you guys. All offering their services cheaper than normal. So if this is the future of concerts for a while, everyone involved is going to make less money. The audience member will probably have to pay more too, but for music lovers, it's all worth it.
Bodies in motion!
Unless your favorite concert experience is the mosh pit. And not to brag, but my friends in high school had a ska band, so you know, I've seen some things, all right? Start Here is produced by David Ryan, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Trevor Hastings, Susie Liu, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Station Ishisku. Special thanks this week to Mei Ju, Vanessa Diaz, Matthew Mosk, Chris Berry, and Kurt Villarosa. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.